So we are going to start our discussions on impairment. Who is going to start?
Etienne will kick off with the outreach summary.
Etienne, please.
Well, the outreach summary is paper 5A. The purpose of this paper is to provide the boards with an understanding of the main messages received from our outreach meetings with users, regulators, standard setters, and preparers from various jurisdictions. I'll begin by giving a brief overall summary and then touch on the main points to the four groups I just mentioned. Overall, the vast majority of our constituents, including non-US users, support a model that distinguishes the measurement of the allowance balance between financial instruments that have deteriorated from those that have not. The reasons for this support include that it achieves a practical balance between economics and operational complexity. It is closely aligned with credit risk management practices. It will provide useful, relevant, and timely information. And that it measures lifetime expected losses only on assets that have deteriorated, which is believed to be operationally more realistic and reliable compared to measuring lifetime expected losses for all instruments. Now, in terms of feedback we received for specific groups, for users, we met with investors and analysts representing more than 20 different organizations from different geographies during IASB only and joint with the FASB outreach. As discussed in paragraph 13 of the agenda paper, overall users were supportive of a move to an expected loss model. However, we reserved that there was a geographical split in the feedback among the timing of about the timing of recognition of expected credit losses, as discussed in paragraphs 14 and 16 through 18. While the majority of non-US users support a model that distinguishes the amount of expected losses recognized for assets that have deteriorated in credit quality from those that have not, the majority of US users prefer a model where lifetime expected credit losses are always recognized. Non-US users supported our model because it better reflects the economics of lending and provides a clear indication of deterioration in credit quality. In contrast, U.S. users prefer a lifetime expected credit loss model because reserve adequacy is more important to them, and they were more focused on a balance sheet view. These geographical preferences are consistent with the feedback from a global survey on the ISB and FASB proposals that CFA Institute independently undertook during our comment letter period. In that survey, global respondents were slightly supportive of the ISB model, more so than the FASB model. And overall, users were very interested and supportive of the disclosures in both the ISB and FASB models. However, many requested more granular disclosure requirements, in particular in the areas about credit migration and flow information about the changes in the loss allowance and the corresponding effect on profit and loss. We also met with both securities and prudential regulators during our outreach. While security regulators supported our model based on operators, they were also concerned about the reliability of a lifetime expected loss estimate because there is little or no data available on assets that have no signs of credit deterioration. So looking at the feedback overall, we can say that we received a lot of support for our model, and convergence is still important to many. Unfortunately, we didn't get many suggestions on how to converge, but some suggested moving forward with a model that builds on distinguishing good assets from other assets.
So we lost the audience for a time, I think, or the
connection? We were stopping the webcast.
Okay, all right. We don't have to do it again. Thank you for this very clear presentation. Philippe.
I'd like a small clarification, Yonan. On paragraph 42, little c, concern expressed by certain standard setters that preparers should prefer the deterioration is determined at an obligor level. Isn't it already in our proposal? Or do we say you must only look at the instrument or the loan issued and do not look at the obligor as a whole to determine whether this obligor has deteriorated in credit risk. It's new to me that we had an issue here. Can you clarify?
So I think this relates to, so in the proposals, obviously we are reporting about the performance of an asset.
Yes.
And so there was a concern raised that because from a credit risk perspective, their entities look at the credit risk of the borrower,
yes,
and only update that each period and don't essentially track what was the original credit quality of a specific loan. So they there was a concern to go on the transaction level. However, during the field work that we have performed, people found ways to operationalize this within their credit risk systems and the data they have. So, for example, they said whenever a new loan is originated, it goes through an application process, and the counterparty gets a new rating. And this rating, we basically store this rating so we know that what that rating is. And so then they could apply the proposals on a transaction level rather than on an obligor level. The problem is if you do it on an obligor level that you might end up having to recognize lifetime expected credit losses for instruments that don't have deteriorated significantly.
Yet. Yeah, but if the obligor has deteriorated, and unless this specific instrument has special features, that is a special ranking of priority or special covenants or whatever, the credit risk of the instrument is not different from the credit risk of the obligor in most cases, unless there is some special feature. So
yes,
having the obligor as the indicator of credit risk seems very logical. And it's only by exception that you could say this instrument has a different credit risk from the obligor as a whole.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Or
sorry,
I'm saying something stupid.
No, sorry. So I'm sitting there. Although that's true, it might be that the obligator, the word English, is the same as the instrument. I think the principle that we have to remember is of significant deterioration. And the risk that we have is if you have one counterparty and over a period of time, you've issued at different point different instruments, it's fine to update for the latest credit risk and what you consider the rating,
yes,
and that everything should be updated to that.
Yes.
The question is, has all instruments significantly deteriorated from the point at which you originated them?
Right.
And that's where the difference is coming in from transaction level versus on a counterparty level, because
so
it might be that one or two instruments have significantly deteriorated, but not all of them.
So you
and
might
that is the distinction we need to make.
So you might have a distinction between a bond of a sovereign that you bought yesterday versus one you bought 3 years ago. So even though it's the same sovereign, depending on when you bought the bond, you may or may not have suffered significant deterioration.
Yes, but what's the consequence of that? Does that mean that I could have two different assessments of two different instruments issued with the same obligor and have different accounting in terms of allowance just because of the history, because it was
yes,
is it a bit odd?
Well, the principle, the idea is that if I bought the bond yesterday, I would have bought it at a different price than 3 years ago before
yes,
the deterioration happened.
Yes,
which in if you look at sovereign risk right now in Europe would be very significant difference. But then you would have a pretty high 12-month PD on those latest bonds, I suppose. Tom?
The conversation we're having right now is just about individual instruments or obligors. It doesn't encompass general changes in macroeconomic conditions, other factors that might indicate credit risk at a broader level. And I think it misses some of the point of both of our models, that it ought to be considering not just the counterparty's individual risk for individual instruments, more broadly the credit risk position within the economy, the issuer's circumstances, the borrower's circumstances, et cetera.
Okay.
And that is one of the points that the regulators, like the Basel Committee, have asked us to take a closer look at, and which I think we will have to enhance a little bit in our model. That changing macroeconomic conditions can imply significant deterioration of at least a part of your portfolio.
Right. At the portfolio level, not necessarily at the instrument or obligor level.
Yes. Pat?
Just an observation. When I read this paragraph, I was a bit surprised because I think it's a non-issue. And the reason is if we're measuring credit risk based primarily on whether there's been a change in probability of default, most instruments have cross-default provisions. So if you have a single obligor with two or three issues, if you default on one, you default on all three. So it basically becomes a non-issue in my view. If you have different cross-default provisions or you don't have them at all, then it becomes more of an issue. But if I issued a bond in 2009, I issue another one in 2013, you know, most likely you're going to have a cross-default provision. So if you default on the 9, you've defaulted on the 13 and vice versa. So it's rare that you – now, your expected loss could differ because of collateral, you know, and things like that. But we're not measuring, you know, the credit deterioration based on – EL, we're measuring it based on PD.
Oh. I'm going to shift gears to another paragraph. So, okay. Didn't know if Harold, did you have one? Okay. Can we go back to paragraph 14? You made comments about users, U.S., non-U.S., and drawing some distinctions. I want to see if we can dig a little bit further into the detail. Could you give me a general assessment of the 20 organizations? Were they sell side? Were they buy side? And then within those groupings, were they industry analysts? Were they accounting analysts if they were on the sell side? And on the buy side, were they portfolio managers, analysts? Were they specialists, generalists? Could you give us some sense of and whether there are any specific trends there?
Barbara can answer
that. Oh.
Yeah. So we had a good mix actually of buy side, sell side, and between equity and fixed income. We had actually equity buy side, sell side was mostly mixing more. We had fixed income was mostly buy side. We had a little bit less of the asset managers, about 5%. We had even less accounting analyst percentage, that was about 3%. So I'd say the vast majority, if you want to split, probably 40-40, we had fixed income, equity, buy side, sell side. And then from that, they were mostly banking, financial institution focus. A couple of generalists thrown in there.
The reason I ask that question is that one of the things that I found common amongst all the, and I think Shandy or someone will do a summary from our side, is that regardless of the measurement, and paragraph 14 focuses on the measurement, all analysts that we talked to, even those that disagreed with our model, wanted full lifetime expected loss. They thought that was good informational content. And what I didn't see in this paragraph or throughout is there some common ground there that all analysts, regardless of the measurement, did they find expected lifetime useful information?
I'm not sure we got that same strong message. I'm looking at my user board members. I wasn't involved in a lot of the user outreach. I'm not sure, though, that we got the same general message that I've heard from Hal before about a desire for disclosure, at least, of the lifetime expected credit losses, you know, sort of separate from the recognition, if you like.
Stephen?
No, we didn't. I was quite surprised, but we didn't hear that call for even disclosure of lifetime losses, have to say.
That surprises me, too, and I'm baffled. Having followed the sector and been an investor in the sector for 15, 20 years, I am shocked that that did not come through as at least information that would be of interest and usable by investors.
I think perhaps that they felt it was a forecast, and questions about reliability of such a forecast. And it's their job to arrive at that type of forecast and not necessarily wanting management to provide it. It's a bit like a forecast of revenue for another type of organization. That was my impression.
The only time that I've heard of analysts, I would agree with Stephen. I didn't hear anything specifically different. The only time I've heard analysts wanting that information is in a marketplace or when there's been tangible evidence that there's been a significant deterioration. Then they kind of want the peak to trough kind of change in, you know, an asset class. But if you're just originating day one, that typically hasn't been my experience, or I didn't hear it necessarily on any of these calls or you know, face-to-face meetings. But I can recall, you know, going to Japan in 1997, 98 as an insurance analyst and having conversations with that industry and saying, you know, what's the peak to trough change here? You've been in this environment for 10 years. You've been under distress. Can you give me that estimate?
What they seemed to be interested in was the credit quality at which the institution or the entity was lending for that particular product. And I think they felt that told them information that allowed them to make an assessment of what they thought were the expected losses at initiation. So it was more the kind of general business description information that they were looking for rather than specific numbers.
And it was more concentrated, based on my experience, of the more risky part of your assets and not of the good book. Because they also want to know, when I work, for example, at Deutsche Bank, how do you classify in management judgment what is good quality assets, medium and high risk assets? And what is really the management's expectation about this high risk asset and what is the provision for that, but not so for the good book that was not of any interest for them.
And this may be a function of the way the U.S. markets developed. And, you know, I noticed the trend starting in 98. Where investors started to realize there was a significant gap between economic reality and accounting theory. And that gap widened post-98 for various and sundry reasons. And I think investors got to be more and more focused on what the economic reality of lending actually was. And what I heard from U.S. investors was that even if they preferred an incurred model, and there were a few longtime analysts who I've known for a very long time, they preferred an incurred model, they still wanted to know management's expectations about losses going in, because that too gave them. So they separated what was useful information, regardless of how they got it, versus measurement. And so when I saw that difference, I was thinking along those lines. And it may be a function of the way the markets have developed over time. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? No? And continue with the paper on fieldwork.
Yes.
Field.
Okay, so paper 5B summarizes some of our main observations and the information that we gather during our fieldwork. So in addition to the general outreach meetings, the staff also undertook detailed fieldwork with a small group of participants. The fieldwork is not yet finalized at this point, and we do intend to bring in September a full analysis of the results of the fieldwork to the board. We conducted the fieldwork with around 15 participants. It was a small group, but the reason is that we've asked these people to do detailed calculations on real-life portfolios. So it was quite resource-intensive from the perspective of the participants. The participants included both financial and non-financial institutions. In addition, these participants were from different regions in the world, different levels of sophistication, and in their credit risk management systems, and comprised some multinational entities as well as some country-based entities. The primary objective of this fieldwork was to understand how would our proposals react to different economic circumstances. In addition, because we asked the participants to do some detailed calculations, we were able to also draw some comparisons and were also able to see the operationality concerns of our proposals. To do the fieldwork, we asked the participants to consider the impairment proposals and to apply to a representative selection of portfolios that they select. So in other words, real portfolio information was used from the participant side. We then provided the participants with an economic circumstance over a period of 7 years that they could then apply to these portfolios. Appendices A to C in the document illustrates the detailed fieldwork guidance that we've given to the participants, as well as Appendix C that includes the economic data that we have provided. We asked the participants to consider how they would estimate their allowances based on IAS 39 currently, the proposals in the ED, and if they were to apply lifetime expected credit losses to all the financial assets that they tested. The main qualitative feedback was consistent with the messages in Paper 5A, which Dean and I presented just now. Some additional points specific by the field participants, the first one being what Philippe had touched on, is the unit of account to assess the credit risk. Participants in general were concerned in the beginning that they would have to do this assessment on a counterparty level. But throughout the process, the participants were able to obtain data and able to assess significant deterioration on a transaction level. It does require from participants to have that information available, but often these entities did have it available. It was just worth a little more effort to obtain that information. In addition, participants supported applying forward-looking information into their allowances. However, there were some issues that they raised. These include specific what macroeconomic factors to apply to the portfolio. From the perspective that the macroeconomic factors that you have to apply has to show a relationship to the increased risk of probability of default. So although participants were able to do that, it did take them some consideration to think what would be those relevant macroeconomic factors. In addition, secondly, participants had to consider how they would apply those macroeconomic factors and be able to filter it down to a transaction level to assess how macroeconomic changes would impact the significant deterioration on a transaction level. Paragraph 13 includes some suggestions to what participants has told us, how they suggest we can better include that information where they cannot capture it on a transaction level. Paragraph 17 to 26 in the paper discuss some of the directional impact of the proposals as well as the size of the impact. The quantitative feedback in general shows that the model is more responsive to changes in economic conditions than the current IAS 39 model. Additionally, the losses are recognized earlier and grow more rapidly during a deteriorated economic environment. Generally, we did see a noticeable increase in the allowances during the entire life of the asset throughout the cycle. And overall, the allowances varied with comparison today depending on how the entity today apply IAS 39, for example, the use of IBNR, and there were some jurisdictional differences that also arose. Secondly, mortgages were also considered to have a higher impact than other portfolios because of the longer nature of these products, which has a more substantial effect when we start to extrapolate and take over the life of the asset, the expected losses. Lastly, the difference that we saw between the uplift if we were to apply our proposals versus a full lifetime was 100%. Now, to clarify what we mean by that, it does not mean that lifetime allowances is double that of the proposals in our ED. Rather, it's a relative comparison. So if we take an example where our allowance today is 100 and it increases by 25% in our proposals, that would give us a new balance of 125. However, the participants, if they were to calculate lifetime expected losses, might increase that allowance from 100 to 150. So the 25 compared to the 50 is the 100% that we are talking about. I now open the floor for discussions on the fieldwork.
Cal? I'd go to back to paragraph 9 just so I understand the process you went through. You said that there were a number of field test participants, they used particular portfolios, and all those portfolios which were listed out in paragraph 9 totaled up to about $500 billion?
Yes.
Okay. I tried to do something similar a year and a half, 2 years ago in the U.S., and I looked at the portfolios of the major U.S. banks and came and very quickly realized that a portion of them were already at lifetime, a portion were near lifetime loss, and there was a portion typically less than 40% of the entire portfolio. Do you think that these, and this looked like to me a very small sample of $500 billion. It sounds like a big number until you realize the U.S. loan portfolio is probably $7 trillion, and globally, I don't know what the number is, double, triple that, $20 trillion, whatever the number is. So it sounded small. Did this focus on that portion of the portfolio that was not currently at Lifetime?
So I think, for one, to consider just the size of it, obviously we had asked them to do detailed calculations, which meant that the entities could not go and apply to their entire business, because that would be way too resource intensive. So generally, participants selected portfolios for which they had a lot of rich data and was able to do the calculations. Secondly, then, in terms of the type of portfolios that they selected, they would, let's say, either select a country as a portfolio and let's use a retail mortgage. So they might select a retail mortgage in a specific country and then do their calculation on that. Now, that portfolio does include some in what our model would be stage three. Some would then be in the IBNR phase, which was some bit of stage two. So it did have elements of all the stages, but also there was still a big stage one, which is basically originated the way you anticipated a good performing book. So that was the kind of portfolios generally that there was. So the portfolio wasn't just to be everything in stage one. It covered all three of the stages, essentially.
I'm having a hard time understanding the numbers in paragraphs 22B and 24B.
Yes.
Where you're talking about differences under a full lifetime loss model in the worst conditions, which means to me it's deteriorated as far as it's going to ever deteriorate. And that means most of there will be in both models a lot of instruments that have deteriorated enough to get to lifetime. So the difference between 110% and 450% under the two models has to be singularly attributable to your stage one assets versus our lifetime assets. When it's fully, when we are in the most fully deteriorated condition. And I'm having, it isn't jiving to me remotely how that could, how the stage one assets that in their worst deterioration would still not be significant enough to be lifetime, that there would be that percentage difference in the reported results. And so it's sort of, can you explain? I don't get it.
I think when it comes to, first of all, lifetime expected credit losses, I think one thing that we have to acknowledge is that people had different ways to try and simplify that simulation because it's difficult to calculate in the first case. Secondly, it is a fact of stage one does drive a lot, because just because it's a bad economic environment doesn't mean everything has gone bad or everything is equally at risk. Because if unemployment goes down, different industries are differently affected. So there's a lot of factors that go into play with that. So when that happens, we still have big stage one assets because a lot of are still performing. As long as they're performing in the range that you priced them, they are still in stage one. So it is definitely a significant uptick from having a 12-month to a full lifetime for those assets. That's the first. And secondly, also why that might be is especially your good performing book has usually got a lot longer period that is expected to perform. So often what you can also find is that maybe the stage two has got a shorter period, depending on the facts and circumstances. But because stage one generally has the assets with a longer performing period still ahead, an uplift is also more significant within that stage.
Well, so it made sense to me the mortgage portfolio difference would be different than a non-mortgage portfolio because you got a longer duration there. But if I've looked at any loss emergence curves on mortgage portfolios, they're still front-end loaded. They're still occurring within the first 3-4 years where the most of it's there. I'm not seeing in the worst deteriorated conditions that you could possibly, unless somebody's extrapolating a 12-month PD times 10, because you got a lot of your portfolio already in lifetime, because it's the worst conditions. It's going to be the worst, the biggest percentage in lifetime in both models. So it just didn't, the numbers didn't quite jive to me as being realistic.
But that's not the case, because I think even in the worst case scenario, it is not that more than 50%, for example, of a retail portfolio is then already in bucket two. Because even if you, for example, in worst case scenario, you have maybe an unemployment rate of which you could be very, very high of 15%, but not 50% or 60%. And that means really that the portion of portfolio is really the maturity is still in bucket one, and even in a worse situation. That is not that we have already then moved more than 50% or whatever then in bucket two.
But if you're in the worst case condition, our lifetime estimate can't be much bigger than yours because it's not going to get any worse.
No, because we have still a high portion in bucket one. And that's the reason for that.
Plus, the new originations are also still in stage one in our model, versus they get lifetime loss in your model.
Sorry, Jana, can you
explain? I was just saying, in addition to that, talking about deterioration and how many assets might have deteriorated, new originations in our model go into the 12-month expected loss measure, and yours, all of them, go into lifetime expected loss.
Daryl, did you want to come in?
I was just going to say that one other thing that I think drives the mortgage numbers and makes the mortgage numbers look particularly odd in this sort of example is in many of the countries that are the jurisdictions that I saw, the amount of absolute loss on those mortgage portfolios is very, very small. It was a very, very small loss. The incremental uptick of not a big amount actually increased the percentages quite significantly. If you start with a small number, so I think that also, and then the other thing that came through is I think at least some of the books I saw are interest-only payments. And that means actually you don't have the necessary drop-off that you would normally see on a mortgage book when you're paying interest and principal. You're holding the it means the longer-dated losses do come through to an extent greater than what you would normally expect on a mortgage book.
Yes, Mary?
I just wanted to check my understanding of Tom's question. Tom, were you looking at paragraph 22 of the paper? Is that right?
I was comparing the B paragraphs from 21 and 22 and 23 and 24.
Okay, because.
And so in 24B, it suggests a 450% on average expected lifetime loss for mortgage portfolio versus 110. And what I'm having a hard time understanding is we're talking about, for our model, mortgages that are high quality, low risk, that are in stage one at this point in time. It's the worst conditions that you're going to have, and they still are stage one for you. So the magnitude of the lifetime loss, if they're that high quality, can't be that high. It just can't be that high to me to leverage from 110% to 450%. Because it's high quality in the worst times, the lifetime loss can't be high.
Where's the 110?
23B.
I think said another way.
Mortgage or non-mortgage. It's going to be mortgage or non-mortgage.
I think that's the wrong comparison.
22B.
No, 23B.
22B is 110.
Oh.
Right, that's non-mortgage.
So I was looking at 130% at 23B, not 110.
Okay, no, that's fine. I'm just trying to match up the numbers to make sure I literally understood the comparison.
I think what Tom's question is trying to get at is absent origination, so these are existing loans, and the FASB model would have expected losses within bucket one, whereas the ISB model does not. If there has been a deterioration, obviously the expected losses in the FASB model would rise and you would move to bucket two. But if there hasn't been a deterioration, you would not move to bucket two, and there should not be an increase in the expected losses associated with those loans. So when you're comparing the FASB and the ISB's model, when you've had a substantial deterioration, which is how you would interpret the B section of 22, there shouldn't be as great an increase between those, because
the FASB's model expected losses, which should be the same as the ISB's model. I think that's what Tom's getting at, right?
And I was giving the wrong numbers all over the place.
One thing that I'm not quite understanding, you know,
it's the 80 to 450 comparison.
As time passed by, there will be still some increase, you know, based on the deterioration, but not jump to black time. But the percentage is still gradually increase, as I understand. Will not be stable number.
I agree with you, but this was in the worst case scenario. In the worst case scenario, you would have thought that things have gotten bad and your loans would have moved to bucket two, which if that was the case, the measurement should be the same between the two boards.
Well, but the difference is not between 400 and 550%. So
I wasn't talking about that.
I mean, that's a much smaller difference than in the previous measurement. So I
think Daryl's point about this being percentages may be confusing us. It might have been better to have actual dollar amounts because your point I did not think about that. If you start with a low number. And a low increase and a low number is going to be a big percentage.
And I think bearing in mind that what you might be talking about is, let's say, 0.5% of the portfolio has moved from 1 to 2.
Yeah.
You're still talking about the other 99% of the portfolio that would be subject to the lifetime loss. So in a high-quality portfolio, which is generally what a mortgage, with very low expectation, it kind of ratchets up the numbers or leverages up the numbers.
It's a different understanding what worst-case scenario we have given in the field test to the people who participated. A worst-case scenario which said, for example, assume that unemployment rates to 15%, assume that house prices are going down 30%. But that does not mean that all your mortgage loan will get sour and deteriorated. And even, I think, if you would say, okay, all of your loans would be then, okay, really got deteriorated, then I would agree to you, but that was not the case. The worst case scenario was that still the majority of the loans will be in bucket one. And that is what we observe in any crisis, that not all of the retail or mortgage loan got sour. It is a certain percentage. Or not.
I wasn't trying to say there was a huge percentage in bucket two. I was trying to say the difference has to be bucket one.
Yeah.
Right? It has to be bucket one. And if you're in the worst case, and they're still low credit risk because they're in bucket one, they can't have that big of a lifetime loss. That leverage can't be that big if they're low credit risk.
But
if they start with
a
very, very small number.
But if you, for example, if you would go to Germany and would, for example, have a 30-year term mortgage loan, the difference between a 1 year and a full lifetime expected loss is huge. It's huge. It depends really absolutely depending on the term. If you have 3 to 4 year loans, maybe not, but if you go to specific jurisdictions, which they have 20, 30 year term loans, the amount which we have seen on number between 1 year and full lifetime is huge.
And I would agree with that, and it would be exacerbated in good times when you could evolve in lifetime to bad times. Where I'm having a hard time understanding that when you're in the worst of times and you're still low credit risk, I don't think the difference can be anything but a low base. So I think the percentages are exaggerated in a sense.
Tom, I also think just when you talk low credit risk, what you mean is it's not deteriorated from where you originated. Because it doesn't necessarily mean you originated at low credit risk. Because remember, with us, something is... If it's in low credit risk, yes, it's stage one. But some of these products aren't even originated in low credit risk. But if you've adequately priced them, you should not be penalized if they're still performing the way that you've priced them. So it doesn't mean necessarily that they just are low credit risk. It just means where it got originated, you've adequately priced for it, and it's not significantly deteriorated from where you priced it. So it doesn't mean we saying it is low credit risk. We are saying it's not deteriorated from where you priced it.
Mark, and so how do you pick up the loss at all? Because the pricing, let's say you did issue mortgages at 18%, and it didn't get any worse than 18%. The pricing has contractual cash flows of 18%, discounted at 18%, bringing you back to principal. Same thing that would happen if you issued a 6% mortgage loan. you bring it back to the same principle. So you don't differentiate a 6% loan from an 18% loan anywhere.
Well, you do in that the 12-month measure is higher, but also even if the loan when you originated was high risk, if it is the one that's going to go bad in the portfolio at some point in time, it would be identified and moved to lifetime. I think the only point is that you may well have decided that only X percent of the portfolio is actually significantly deteriorated as a result of the macroeconomic assumptions we've given people, so only that portion has moved to lifetime at this point of time in the model. But there's still a significant, it's not a low credit risk item in stage one, which is appeals.
I wanted to flip to somewhat to paragraph 19, which tries to describe the basis for some of these differences that you're talking about, one of which is IBNR, which I fully appreciate. And so my question is, well, you lay out that IBNR and the different emergence periods that you had explain some of the differences, and if you could just give me a little color on what those ranges were like in terms of emergence periods, roughly, if you have it. And was any of the 15 a U.S. domiciled field test? Or no?
The field participants that we have, even the multinational ones, did not prefer to test their U.S. portfolios. So the portfolio itself has not been in the U.S.
So what were the ranges roughly? I mean, so were they all less than a year, or were some of them more?
Some are more than a year. They are short periods, less than a year, even way less. And then there are that go from 18 months, 24, 36.
Yeah. Okay. Quite a big range.
Yeah, it is a big range.
Right.
Would those have had a decrease then?
Those would have had a decrease, I would have imagined.
It depends on your portfolio. So if, for example, let's say you had maybe a 3 years, it depends on what you did with stage two, because sometimes what might happen is, yes, you might have a little bit of a decrease for stage one, but your stage two is moving to lifetime, which wasn't necessarily what they were doing today. So it doesn't mean
when
that
you
overall
say,
you
when
have
you say
a decrease.
They have 3 years, they based their IBNR on 3 years?
Yes.
So the IBNR was 3 years. So for the assets in stage one, maybe, yes, but now they have to do 12 months, but then because the assets in stage two was also 3 years, but now has to be lifetime, that had a
so you're saying the ones that were in stage two under IAS 39 were not getting lifetime?
It depends.
It depended.
Yeah.
So in our model,
because
we would have said if you had significant credit deterioration, I'm thinking FAS 114.
But I think it's also to clarify that when you say in stage two didn't have lifetime, that meant that they had not individually assessed it for impairment to be lifetime. So only once something is at the point where individually you assessed it for impairment to go to lifetime, only then would you move it. But that is not stage two for us today. So
you only move to lifetime with individual assessment?
No.
It's 39.
39.
That's
not,
39.
Not the model.
So that's what I've been trying to figure out. So I've been thinking about it because my understanding is in the U.S. it's not constrained to 1 year, like loss emergence mm-hmm. periods. And so I had the reaction that Russ did, that if you had a loss emergence period today of greater than 12 months and then you went to a 12-month expected loss, you'd actually paradoxically be reducing the amount of expectations that you'd incorporate.
Yeah, exactly. You would move them to lifetime losses earlier than you would move them under IS 39 today.
I think
so
essentially
your
population
of IBNR is split essentially between some being in stage one and some already have moved to lifetime expected losses.
I think you could certainly, it would certainly, I think, be the case that it's more likely that you would have less of an uptick or maybe no uptick at all if you had a longer IBNR. But it's a bit tricky comparing just the allowance balances because the reasons are so different. So you could have bigger IBNR in current application of 39, for example, and you may have a similar allowance balance, arguably, under the new model, but that's because you've got a shorter 12-month outlook for your stage one, but you've moved things more quickly to stage two. So you've sort of got those two counterbalances.
You've got the two things, yeah. Because I've been worried not about less of an uptick, but actually a reduction.
Yeah.
and thinking that I'm actually incorporating fewer expectations. But I have to, you're right, I have to assess the other moving part as well, which is the trigger of when you get to under 114 versus that.
And the tricky thing, I think, in the field work is obviously people could only deal with the information they already had available and the information we gave them. So there was lots of caveats about, you know, this is what we've done now to do the field work for you, but it's not necessarily what we'd do in practice. So
same in our outreach.
There's a caveat on that.
Can I ask a question about the conclusions? The volatility which is created by the proposals.
Which?
It's paragraph 26A, and it's also somewhere in the explanation that to a certain extent the model does create more volatility in the amount of allowances which build up more quickly and then the norm diminish more quickly. This volatility can be seen as purely accounting outcome, no consequence. Right. But in effect, in reality, and maybe it's a question for the scenario, the economic scenario you provided to the banks, did they consider that this volatility in the amount of reserves can be offset by raising capital, by having sufficient capital base to just ignore it, or whether an assumption that this economic, this accounting volatility might have some impact on the business, hence having a real procyclical effect on the economics, and hence by itself fuel more of the downward scenario. Because what we observed during the crisis was that the accounting outcome did have an impact on behavior of the banks, which were unable to raise capital, and that to cut their lending, hence increasing the effect on the real economy and creating more downward cycle. So was it part of their modelization, or did they have to ignore the economic impact of this accounting volatility?
We didn't ask them to look at that as such, because I think particularly for the banks, the sort of unknown at the moment is how the regulators would react if we moved to this model. So it's a bit.
Yeah, but we have to make an assumption that the accounting outcome will have some impact on the regulatory capital. And that this might trigger some changes in behavior of the bank, like cutting new loans and just reducing their lending, which by itself does create some bad economic outcome.
I have to disagree that this data tells us anything about volatility. It tells us about allowance at a point in time. It doesn't tell us about how that allowance built up over time. And in the lifetime setting, you could end up, as you're going from boom to bust cycle, you could end up sooner gradually building to the lifetime through a lifetime assessment than the pent-up way it would happen if you're in stage one for a period of time, in a period of time, and then you trip over and you jump. That volatility, that change might be bigger than what happens when you gradually build it up in a lifetime. I don't think these numbers tell us the pattern of year-to-year buildup to any of the allowance amounts. It could go either way. I'm not saying which way it is, but I don't think conclusions can be made about that.
I was just thinking, Tom, to what is said in paragraph 16BA, which asserts that there is more a quicker buildup and a quicker. So it may be wrong, but if that is true, then that's another question.
First of all, there is a real economic effect in these economic cycles, because that's what economic cycles are all about. The accounting does always reflect that to some extent. I think both our models diminish the cliff effect relative to current factors, because in both models, provisionally will happen at an earlier level, earlier time. Yours will have less of a cliff effect than ours, because it builds up from the very beginning and builds up quite substantially. The question then is, does that really reflect economic performance or not? But that's in terms of do the models have a pro-cyclical effect? I think less so, or they reflect the pro-cyclicality of the economy itself, less so than the current loss model. But yours model, less so than ours.
I would agree, our model less so, because the management attributes the same throughout. the cycle.
Yeah.
I think when you change the measurement attribute, you clearly will have additional changes in reserve because of changes in underlying economic conditions. I don't think that's avoidable. I don't think it should be avoided. I think it's the different measurement attribute that a lot of people argue results in pro-cyclicality. I do agree that your proposal reduces that over what you have today.
Yeah.
I think it might on paper, in the, at least as things are practiced in the U.S., I'm not sure it does.
I said their model over what.
Yeah, their model versus IAS 39, not their model versus
FAS
5 and FAS 114.
And there are some regions in the world where they apply IFRS now with a very generous use of IBNR, where the effect will be close to zero.
Right.
Well, it will react differently in changing economics, so we have to be careful because, it's again, you might start off with more allowance balances, but the profile can still react differently with changing economics over time than 39 would today because it's more forward-looking, the proposals.
Any other comments or questions?
Nope.
Thank you, Q. And
then Rihanna is doing her comment.
Thank you. So agenda paper 5C summarizes the messages we received in our comment letters on our expected credit loss ED. The comment period closed on the 5th of July, and at the time of posting this agenda paper, we've received 175 comment letters, of which 8 comment letters were from users or the representative groups. Subsequent to the posting of the agenda paper, we've received another 9 comment letters, which included a further 2 comment letters from user groups. And the views expressed in these additional comment letters are consistent with the messages we've included in our agenda paper. An analysis of the comment letters by type and geographic region is provided in Appendix A of the agenda paper. Now, overall, the vast majority of respondents, including the users, supported the model that distinguishes the measurement of expected losses based on the extent of credit deterioration. So, you know, a model that distinguishes the assets that have deteriorated from those that haven't. Users in particular found this distinction useful and relevant as it reflects change in credit quality over the life of the instrument. Most of the respondents consider the proposed model to reflect the underlying economics of a lending transaction in a pragmatic way, while easing the complexities that we had with the 2009 exposure draft. Their reasons for supporting the model included reflecting the economic loss that arises from changes to your initial expectations in expected credit losses. It is closely aligned to credit risk management practices, and it avoids the excessive front-loading of expected credit losses. Only a few respondents supported a model that recognizes lifetime expected losses since initial recognition, and they welcomed the apparent simplicity of such a model based on a single measurement objective, and they believe the full loss content of financial instruments is useful and relevant information for the users. The vast majority of respondents, however, did not support a lifetime model. They consider such a model to totally disregard the economic link between the pricing of an instrument and the initial credit quality, and thereby diminishing the relevance of financial reporting. There were, however, a few respondents, including regulators, some preparers, and users, that did not support either of these models. And their reasons were that none of these models achieves the objective of providing information about the economic yield in the way that the 2009 exposure draft would. They think these models are more judgmental than IAS 39 is today because it includes forward-looking estimates. And the assessment of significant deterioration added another layer of complexity to this model. the proposed model. Now, although many respondents still prefer convergence on a single impairment model, many of them noted they would prefer that solution to be similar to the model that we have proposed in our exposure draft, so a model that distinguishes. However, some of the respondents urged the ISB to finalize the proposed model as soon as possible, with or without convergence in that case. Now, despite their support for the ISB model, many respondents did have some concerns with our model, and they requested clarification and further guidance on how to apply the proposed requirements. And these concerns were similar or aligned to what was raised during the outreach meetings and during the fieldwork. The areas they've most frequently included in their concerns were the 12-month expected losses, the assessment of significant deterioration, the choice we have in the discount rates that you can use, the simplifications we've proposed in the exposure draft, and then some of the disclosures as well. With regards to the time needed to implement the proposals, nearly all of the respondents indicated that they would need around 3 years to implement our proposals. Based on the feedback we've received to date, and subject to some of these clarifications and enhancements that respondents have asked for, and I think most significantly, making sure our model is as forward-looking as we want it to be, the staff think that this, you know, the feedback indicated this model is operational, can be applied, it provides relevant and useful information, and that the model is capable of being finalized as it is. And with that, I'll hand it over to you.
Larry.
So, can you just refresh my memory in terms of what the general reaction was to the original 2009 ED, not from the standpoint of operationality, but in terms of people's views as to whether it was reflective of the economics of lending? And because what I heard you say was there were a few people, you characterize it as a minority or something, that kind of agreed or would go back to the 2009 ED, and that seems to be a little bit different than what I was expecting, at least when it comes to the theory, but maybe my memory is...
I suppose that most people see it as bridge under the water. Water under the bridge.
You might be the first one.
It's the best thing.
But Rihanna, please.
I think in the agenda paper we do set out that although a lot of respondents still regard the 2009 ED as superior in terms of conceptual basis, so it still gives you the, you know, conceptually the best answer, they do acknowledge all the operational difficulties and the reasons we can't go for that model, and that's why they are willing to accept this. Now, that the few respondents I mentioned that still wants the 2009 ED, those are the ones that want it despite everything else.
Okay.
So the others, the majority is willing to accept this.
You were interested in whether...
Okay,
whether
I misread.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think they probably won't prepare us.
No.
You're sure they're not Steve's relatives?
I didn't check.
Daryl.
Rihanna, one thing that did surprise me, and in a couple of meetings I was in that we discussed this, I kind of challenged it and tended to see a different view emerge, was the sort of contradiction between those people, a lot of people saying that they felt this was operationally fairly easy, it took the data that they already had, was part of what they were already using from the information, and the 3 years. And I know in the couple of meetings where I challenged it, people said, yeah, well, 3 years might be pushing it a little bit type of thing. But I think, and I think one particular data I know changed from 3 years to 2 years because of that. But that kind of contradiction, what was the primary reason why people were coming up with 3 years?
What 3 years are you talking about?
They need 3 years to actually prepare for the thing. It seems like a contradiction in terms to say it's using information that's operational and et cetera, but it's going to take 3 years.
I think it's still systems changes to capture the sort of origination information so that it exists in the organisation but maybe not in the accounting systems. And I think the other thing is has just gone out.
So does that then mean, though, that that's primarily about the transitional issues as much as anything else? Because people want to transition.
And I think the other thing is they think they can build on things like, for example, the Basel banks think that they can build on their Basel calculations for the 12-month measure in particular. But I think people still need to build systematized ways of measuring lifetime expected losses and gather a lot of information to support those the historical calculations that they'll use as a basis for building their forward-looking projections. So I think a lot of it's data gathering. It's also making modifications because they can't just use the Basel data. They, even those who have it, need to make adjustments to make it not through the cycle but point in time, etc. So I think it's gathering data and making sure that it's robust enough to be auditable as well, I think, for some of these processes, particularly the forward-look element and the lifetime being more often used.
Stephen?
I wanted to ask about the 12-month allowance and the feedback that we've received on that.
Did it change your mind?
It didn't change my mind. Reading many of the letters and also the summaries here, it's clear that people say it lacks conceptual justification. So paragraph 31 of 5C, respondents consider the 12-month expected loss allowance to be without conceptual justification. In paper 5A, there's some references there. The standard set of feedback in paragraph 40, they say it's not conceptually justified. But then people go on to say, use words like pragmatic solution and proxy for and approximation of. So the standard setters say, not conceptually justified because no economic loss has occurred, but they could support it as an approximation of the yield adjustment being the original 2009 ED. But aren't they just contradicting themselves? Because if it has no conceptual justification, it can't be an approximation for anything. If it is an approximation of the 2009 ED, it must have a conceptual basis. So why is everybody so confused about this? Does it have a conceptual justification because it is an approximation or a proxy for, or is it conceptually flawed? And I couldn't pick that up from the comment letters.
They're acknowledging the fact that it's a very rough proxy. So I think they can see that we wanted to do something about the fact that the contractual interest rate's higher than what you expect to achieve, and they know we're trying to sort of solve for that, if you like, and that the move on significant deterioration doesn't deal with that. But I think they're acknowledging, for all of the concerns that you have, that the amount of the adjustment that's going through P&L isn't really doing a particularly good job of replicating that yield adjustment.
So we could summarise that it's not a faithful representation of the yield adjustment?
Can I just...
This is a leading question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it was rhetorical.
That's even better.
Certainly
and they were merely repeating what we had written down ourselves, which was that we didn't think this was conceptually the right answer, but that we were doing our best to come to a pragmatic solution. Darryl.
I think there's also a part of the problem here. There was certainly in the meetings I was in an acknowledgement of the fact that it was warranted to have some kind of impairment in place before that deterioration event happened. And people weren't uncomfortable with that part of it, having some kind of approximation. They were comfortable with what the approximation was for. The conceptual concern, if you want, that certainly I heard from a lot of people, was the idea that there was a day one impact. And they felt the day one impact was wrong. And so I heard all sorts of things like build up to 12 months over a one-year period, or build up to the 12 months through OCI or something like that. People seemed fairly comfortable with the idea that there was an approximation there and what we were trying to achieve in the balance sheet. But they were really concerned about the idea that you had this day one impact, and they felt that was not conceptual.
BK?
Two questions, Rihanna. One is in this same area that Steve was asking, in the 12-month expected loss. I just wanted to get a flavor from you in terms of the para 29 and para 30 of your paper on the there are, I would think these people are in minority, are in a big minority, where they would think 12 months is the floor and they can go beyond 12 months. But my understanding of this and the comment letters is that vast majority do not approve anything more than 12 months. But I just want to understand, what would be the insurance company's view on this? Any idea? Any specific feedback from the insurance companies on this?
In as far as it affects the investments that they would carry at fair value through OCI, they've made a number of suggestions how we can avoid having day one losses on those investments, or you know, exclude them from the 12 months. So they're not particularly happy about having that day one loss on those high quality instruments, and they've made some suggestions how we can address that.
Okay. And last question in this area, just to go to the purchased credit impaired PCI. You did use the words most and many, and so I just wanted to understand where is the balance from the reading the comment letters and the persuasion point of view, because there is a view about grossing up so that you are consistent across the board in terms of the recognition and the para 88, which is very equal to 2009 ED on the original proposals, and that applies only to the PCI. So I'm a little bit interested to see what is many and what is most.
Many is the majority. Well, most is the majority, sorry.
Thank you.
And many is just the others. A notable minority.
Last question for Gary, and then we move over to the assessment phase.
Granted, the you would just said, you know, people are objecting about putting a day one loss on high quality instruments. But since we're only looking 12 months, wouldn't as a practical matter that number be nil to zero if they're high quality? Is the concern overstated? I appreciate there's work to demonstrate perhaps it's zero, but in concept, if it's high quality, it near zero.
I think in reality that number would be quite low, but I think it is more a case of, you know, conceptually they can't get themselves to recognize day one loss in something that is such a high quality.
Yeah, but they might come out to no reserve is the answer.
I think part of it is conceptual, but I think also some people have heard a lot of rhetoric from us that there'll be allowance balances on all things at all times, and they want confirmation that we don't mean not.
Yeah, we didn't mean that,
material.
Right?
Yeah. If it's immaterial, then obviously the normal rules apply.
Yeah, and there's no intention of having a reserve on something where you don't believe it would ever likely materialize. Right. I would think you would come out to add or near a zero number for high quality instruments.
Okay, I think it's time to move over to the next presentation, which will be done by.
Thank you, Hans, and good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to those in Norwalk. If I could turn your attention to FASB Memo 232 and ISB Agenda Paper 5D. So consistent with the FASB's mission to improve financial reporting in a manner that provides decision-useful information to investors and other users of financial statements, the board and staff developed a multifaceted approach for obtaining feedback on the proposed update, specifically to understand whether the proposed update would achieve the board's mission to improve financial reporting for the benefit of users. The board and staff sought input from investors and other users of financial statements. To understand the operationality and cost of applying the proposed update, the board and staff sought from preparers, auditors, and other parties involved in the financial statement preparation process. Accordingly, feedback was obtained by meeting with approximately 70 analysts and investors, conducting 17 field visits with preparers, and receiving over 350 comment letters from preparers. Today, we'll cover both the investor and the preparer view on the more significant aspects of the proposed update. And after feedback on each significant aspect is summarized, we'll turn it over to the boards for questions. So the significant areas we'll tee up today are international convergence and the general premise of the expected loss model, the amount and timing of loss recognition, debt instruments measured at fair value through OCI, PCI and non-accrual, and other topics such as disclosures and other implementation issues. So regarding international convergence, generally speaking, preparers support the overall objective of the FASB and the ISB to develop a single converged standard on the accounting for expected credit losses. Because they believe that convergence is critical to the success of global capital markets, they are concerned with the differences between the board's respective proposals. They believe that if the boards move forward with the variants of their respective proposed models, financial institutions that prepare financial statements under U.S. GAAP will be at a capital disadvantage compared to those institutions preparing financial statements under IFRS. Investors will be affected when analyzing and comparing financial statements, and preparers would face the operational burden of needing to prepare financial statements under two different models. Now, however, there are some preparers who caution the boards on its efforts towards convergence. While they appreciate the concept of convergence, they recommended that the board concentrate on developing a final standard on credit losses that's an improvement to the current accounting and utilizes existing U.S. GAAP as a starting point. Now, regarding the move to an expected loss model, a majority of preparers agree with the FTAG's recommendation to develop an expected loss model, one that removes recognition thresholds and develops the loss estimate using information about past events, current conditions, and reasonable and supportable forecasts. They believe that the move to an expected loss model addresses the delayed recognition of credit losses and is in direct response to the lessons learned from the recent global financial crisis. Now, some preparers, however, did not support the FCAG's recommendation to move away from an incurred loss model. They suggested that FCAG's recommendation to develop an expected loss model was a knee-jerk reaction to the recent financial crisis and would not have prevented the crisis. In addition, they believe that an expected loss model is inconsistent with the FASB's conceptual framework and would be inconsistent with other loss recognition guidance in U.S. GAAP. So as a result, some preparers believe that a credit loss model should require loss recognition only after meeting an incurred loss threshold or trigger point.
Stephen, can I make a point here?
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point here. First of all, the investors, at least most of the ones that we spoke to, didn't express the view that an expected credit loss model can ever prevent the next crisis. What they did say, however, is that they believe the use of an expected credit loss model would provide more timely information to investors about credit losses expected by management. That would be provided through both the original expectations and the constant revisions to those expectations based on, for example, the actual deterioration that's being experienced or changes in the economy. They also told us that they believe an expected credit loss model would force more rigor and thoughtfulness around growth and pricing decisions, especially when the expected costs of those decisions must be explained to investors at the same time the lending originates. Investors also expressed that the use of expected losses would address the complaints made to them over many years by financial institutions that they are prevented from reflecting the most recent knowledge and information in the financial statements because of artificial restraints imposed by the accounting standards. That being said, obviously the use of expected credit losses brings about additional subjectivity. And investors understand that that significant subjectivity exists in management's forward-looking credit loss estimates. That already exists to some extent in U.S. GAAP as it's applied today. And analysts tell us that they analyze pre-provisions and post-provisions results specifically for that reason, because they understand that there's subjectivity coming through in the reserve. Now, they tell us that here is a place where disclosures can be very, very helpful. And that would be disclosures about the underlying assumptions and the information being used to develop the loss estimates and about how the changes over time can appropriately help them address the subjectivity that is inherently in the estimate. That would be better, they believe, as opposed to not providing the information.
So with that, I will open it up. Thank you, Shandy. So with that, I'll open it up for questions or comments.
We go.
I catch one point. You say, some of you say, if incurred, because it's consistent with requirements for other impairment requirements for other assets. And I heard similar comments in Asia, including from China. And so on that basis, we should be very careful to use the word like conceptually or not. We just talking about, the 12 months or not. And we, from ISB point of view, we honestly say the 12 months is not in line with conceptual basis, or without any conceptual basis. The people have different views about, what is it the amount should be day one or based on any concept.
For example, every board member may say, that, you know, 2 months not enough, or even your time proportionate not enough. And on their based on their views, they would prefer the full lifetime. And similarly, we have controversial in the past. You know, some people may feel full catch-up is conceptually right, but others will feel not. So from that, these examples, I feel in the future, you know, if we want to, by the end, conclude something, and in the basis, we should be careful using the words conceptually or not. It's because people have different understanding about conceptual basis.
And if I could just add, the two people that I heard favored the incurred model, it had nothing to do conceptual. It was simply they were going to make their own loss expectation estimates. And they were both using expected lifetime loss. They just wanted their own, as opposed to having to back out management to put their own in. So there was no conceptual there.
Did they want financial statements at all? Or?
Depends on which one you talk to. One thought he had an advantage over everyone else and said no financials at all. So yes.
Please, Pat.
Steve, question about paragraph 6A and B. This has been a topic that we've talked about on many occasions. I just thought it would be helpful if you could review again or articulate this distinction about the board's intention, the FASB's board's intention, about what in fact the model would impose or require in terms of forecasting economic conditions and what is meant by life of loan. So
absolutely,
we're all on the same playing field.
It's probably a good discussion to have. It is in the second part of my tee up, so okay. We can maybe defer the talks about recognition and measurement till then, because I assume the discussion will just get amplified then.
Daryl B.
Thank you. Steve, in paragraph 5A, where you noted that by nearly a 3-to-1 margin that investors and other users prefer a model recognizing all expected credit losses, was there any indication in the feedback that you got from them as to whether they were focusing, say, specifically on the balance sheet or whether and in doing so, we're just sort of accepting the P&L impact of that, or was there an indication from them that they believe sort of, you know, in its fullest sense that the recognition of it both on the balance sheet and P&L was the appropriate way to go?
Yeah, I actually do think that's a part of maybe what Shandy's going to talk about in the next section as well, so I'll continue to defer.
I'm pleased that I could do the segue for you.
I think we'll have to move to the next presentation quickly. Daryl, you can wait?
I'm going to wait, yeah.
Okay. Tuck?
Just quickly, you mentioned knee-jerk reaction, and I found it very interesting. I actually consulted the dictionary. typical knee-jerk reaction, which happened right after the financial crisis, was we need dynamic provision. Because whenever you have enough earning power, you should reserve as much as possible. And then when it comes to the financial crisis, then you would have enough reserve. Then you can resist the financial crisis. That kind of knee-jerk reaction was prevailing right after the Lehman Shock financial crisis, I remember. And in your paper, somebody worried about the cookie jar provisioning. And I'm curious what kind of discussion was going on within the United States, whether day one loss, lifetime loss model could be cookie jar or could be kind of dynamic provisioning. Because after reading your paper, there are lots of concerns who is worrying about how can I estimate the economic condition or how can I include macroeconomic factors into the day one provisioning. So I wonder, there must be some discussion about what I question.
Yeah, certainly that. I mean, the theme around cookie jar reserving or you know, the ability for management to, I guess, manipulate their financial statements. That, I mean, that did come across a little bit, but it really was not a significant theme throughout all the feedback, whether that was comment letters or any of the outreach that we did. So that's actually why it was not one of the significant, I guess, areas that were captured in our memo.
I would just add to that, when that topic did come up, disclosure followed right after. Let's talk about disclosure, and I know you're going to talk about that in a little bit, but the key element there was, if I know enough about the pieces and parts of the provision itself, the expense that's going through the current period, what's coming through for origination versus changes in past estimates, that's the check and balance on that cookie jar concept. So they looked at it as, we know it's management's number, and give me good disclosure, which they liked, and in fact asked for a little bit more, and they were very specific about that.
It's a strange expression, a knee-jerk reaction, because it's usually meant to be pejorative. But if you do not have a knee-jerk reaction, you have a physiological problem.
I have two observations. First, those that question the outcome of the FCAG process, I think we can all have sympathy given the quality of the leadership of that process. Secondly, I think we've miscommunicated significantly through this whole process about expected versus incurred losses. I think we could all agree that an incurred loss is realized when you don't collect the cash and you've given up collecting on the cash, and we don't wait to recognize losses to that charge-off point. So almost everything in any model we do is an expectation. And the question's going to be, what are the events or the information that triggers us to recognize that expectation? And I think we don't serve well the communication about this at all, to put in an incurred versus expected. But we need to define what it is that are either the loss events that cause us to measure some sort of expectation or the information set. And much of our conversation so far has been about loss events, though we didn't specify them as we've gone forward. But we've been challenged through this whole process to go beyond loss events, to think about information and updating of information, not just default or delinquency, etc., but to begin to think about the changes in the borrower's conditions, the issuer's underwriting, macroeconomic conditions that apply to these things, and when do we build them into an estimate. Those are all expectations.
That's correct. Any other comments? So then we can move over to the next presentation, please.
Jandy?
Sure. Great. So the next piece of our presentation relates to the amount and timing of loss recognition. So before I get into detailed comments, I think I want to give you a little more perspective about who we heard from in terms of investors and analysts. Overall, we spoke to more than 70 investors over the last 6 months. Approximately half of those investors were buy-side analysts that were focused on financial institutions. The remainder of the folks we spoke to were a combination of sell-side analysts, also focused, of course, on financial institutions, ratings agency analysts, and as well some accounting analysts. First, let me talk about the minority. Roughly one quarter of the investors and analysts we spoke to said that they think it's inappropriate to recognize lifetime credit loss, expected credit losses up front for many of the reasons that we've already discussed. And that view existed across all investor perspectives, whether it be buy-side analysts, sell-side analysts, or credit analysts. But in particular, it really existed with the accounting analysts. The reasons for their objections, as I said, were consistent with what we've talked about today and what we've talked about in terms of what preparers are telling us, including concerns about the matching of interest income and credit losses, the reliability of forward-looking estimates for lengthy periods of time, and also regulatory capital hits. Stephen's going to go into more detail about what the preparers told us, so I'll just focus on the investor comments. the majority of the investors and analysts we spoke with, so roughly three quarters or nearly a 3-to-1 margin, they told us that they believe all expected credit losses should be recognized at origination, as opposed to maintaining a threshold that must be met before expected credit losses are recognized, or permitting the recognition of only some of the expected credit losses. You're probably asking yourselves, why would investors want a bank to recognize all of its expected credit losses upfront when that bank has to recognize its interest income over time? Well, the most significant reasons is that investors have the burden of trying to forecast those expected credit losses that will ultimately come through the portfolio. So what they tell us is that as good a starting point as any is to understand management's expectation of what those credit losses are, alongside detailed information about the asset portfolio and how those assets are actually performing. What they tell us is that they're trying to forecast the full loss content in the portfolio because they're trying to determine, obviously, the valuation of the company and whether or not there's potential near-term or long-term earnings risk or capital risk, and whether or not a company's risk-based pricing model is appropriate. So for all those reasons, they tell us that this would be very helpful information. In fact, back to what Hal was saying before, I would say of all the people we spoke to, just a very small handful told us that they didn't want lifetime credit loss information at all. They didn't think it was useful. I would say less than 10, maybe even less than 5 folks. Another reason that the investors and analysts we spoke to support the recognition of lifetime credit losses is that a majority of the investors said that they view the allowance as representing capital set aside to absorb all future expected credit losses. And in this regard, as has been mentioned before, the reserve adequacy is very, very important to them. They don't see any point in recognizing credit losses only if they meet only if default events are expected within a specified time frame. They also don't like the idea of triggers for recognizing all the expected credit losses, which they said, you start with a level of subjectivity and then you're adding another layer of subjectivity onto that. Most investors that we spoke with agreed with the board's decision, which I think Stephen will talk about more, to have preparers revert to historical averages for periods beyond the foreseeable future or periods where estimates can be easily obtained. And what they tell us there is that the historical average would be more informative and they believe more and more economic assumption than assuming zero losses over that remaining period. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Stephen, to discuss what we heard from preparers.
All right. Well, thanks, Shandy. So in contrast to what Shandy just said, obviously preparers had a very different view of the measurement aspects of the proposal. Many preparers stated in their comment letters that forecasting and predicting economic conditions over the remaining life of an asset would be operationally challenging, if not impossible, and would result in providing information to users that's both inaccurate and unreliable. The staff heard similar feedback while conducting field visits with preparers. Now, it's important to note that neither the board nor the FASB staff expected that an entity would be required to develop a forecast of economic conditions over the remaining life of an asset. Accordingly, during these field visits, the board and the staff sought to clarify this misunderstanding by clarifying its original expectation on how an entity would estimate expected credit losses. Specifically, the board and the staff explained that an entity is not expected to forecast and predict economic conditions over the entire life of the asset. Rather, it's only expected to update its historical loss experience for current conditions and reasonable and supportable forecasts about the future, with the forecast being made over a shorter, more reliable period of time. And then for periods beyond those that are able to be reasonably and supportably forecasted, entities could revert to a historical average or at least lock in or freeze the furthest reasonable and supportable forecast. So when provided these clarifications, nearly all preparers participating in the field visits and outreach sessions indicated that the measurement of lifetime expected credit losses is operational, albeit at a significant cost. Now, with regards to the timing of recognition, the majority of comment letter respondents objected to the proposed update for three main reasons. They believe that it understates the net asset value of a financial asset measured at amortized cost on day one. They believe that it fails to match the timing of credit loss recognition with the timing of interest income recognition, and they are concerned about the potential effect on regulatory capital. So regarding the understatement of the net asset value, preparers believe that the recognition of losses on day one would not be reflective of the economics of a lending transaction. They suggest that the immediate recognition of losses will result in a financial instrument being measured and recorded at an amount that is less than fair value at the time of origination, which is inconsistent with the economics of a lending transaction that is based on market terms. Regarding the concern around matching, while preparers acknowledge that it may be difficult to perfectly match the timing of the recognition of credit losses with the timing of the recognition of interest income, many disagreed with the recognition of expected credit losses on day one, as it ignores the timing of the recognition of interest income. Preparers are concerned that such a mismatch in the timing of recognition of credit losses and interest income will confuse investors regarding the preparer's ability to effectively manage its lending activities and credit risk management practices. And lastly, we wanted to provide an update on the quantitative impact of the proposals. As part of our outreach activities, we've received input on the likely impact for U.S. financial institutions in adopting the CECL model or the ISB's proposed model. While the results are indeed preliminary, two primary themes have emerged. First, while the impact will necessarily differ based on an entity's mix of business and current reserving practices, the staff understands that the increase in the level of reserves for U.S. financial institutions would be less than 40%. Second, while the same caveats apply, the staff understands that the three-bucket model would likely result in a decrease in the level of reserves for U.S. financial institutions of approximately 15%. And just to be clear, that's a decrease from where the U.S. financial institutions are applying GAAP today, or as applied today. So with that, I will pause and allow for discussion.
Sorry, you said it would lead to a decrease in reserves of 40%?
No, an increase.
For what?
If they were to go to the ISB's three-bucket model, it would result in a decrease of approximately 15% from where they are today. The 40% is an increase if they went to the CECL model.
So if your reserve were 100, it would go to 140 under CECL, or 85 if we were to apply ISB model.
Was that on transition, or did you look at the effects over a cycle?
No, that was on transition.
And that obviously will change, those percentages will change, because there are points in time when the reserves are very high and very low. So you can have fairly significant changes in those percentages over time.
Could I ask a question on the users' comments? There are numbers there. One of the first reasons I wanted full lifetime was it's good information. And they use it, but it's fairly draconian to put it all on the balance sheet for the sake of information. As Hal said earlier, there's other ways of getting information, like disclosures. You know, it doesn't seem to me a really good reason for underestimating the value of your assets on the balance sheet. And the second one, which really intrigues me, it's capital set aside. I'm not sure why users have that perspective. I'm not sure why they want to think about that.
Well, because I think it's the same as UK investors. We have groups of UK investors here who keep on harping on prudence. I think they burned their fingers during the financial crisis. Saw that, you know, the bank earnings went down the drain. I'm not saying it's a good reason. That's an understandable reason that they would rather have them to err on the cautious side than on the optimistic side.
I don't think that's quite the way I would have summarized it. I think that investors have learned for a long time and over long periods through many cycles that underwriting standards expand and contract. They recognize that there's a cause and effect. When underwriting standards contract or diminish, they know that within 2 to 3 years there is going to be an impact on capital, on earnings, on dividends, on buyback programs. So they'd rather know now what the expectations are.
Yeah, I still would have thought they'd be more interested in the real economics.
That actually is the real economics, that if you diminish your underwriting standards today, that is an economic consequence that will show itself in the coming years.
But if you had the information on the full lifetime losses anyway, you could work that out for yourself. The other one that intrigued me was, and I guess I can understand it, using historical information. I guess the reason is, in some cases, you've got nothing else to try and estimate the future. But history is a really unreliable way of estimating the future most of the time.
Steve, just to follow up on my question, because your comments and the paper clarify the issue, but I would just like to, I guess, use my own words. I'm looking at paragraph B9. Is it fair to say that your model would require you to estimate expected losses over the remaining life of an asset? However, you are not required to forecast economic conditions over that remaining life. So you are making a life of loan, life of asset estimate at all times.
Yes.
However, you do not forecast economic conditions over all times because the information may not be reasonable and supportable.
That's correct.
Now, in doing so, you start with historical information, mm-hmm. and you use historical information based on life of asset experience. So if you had an asset that had, let's say, an expected life of 20 years, you would look at historical life of asset experience of 20 years. Is that correct?
Yes. Including the assumption of prepayments. I mean, yeah. Prepayments.
Obviously, yes. On an option-adjusted basis, yeah. Okay. I think that's an important point that has always, I think, puzzled some people, but I think as long as we're on the same playing field, that makes a lot of sense.
Daryl, you now get to ask your question.
Yeah, I'm going to ask my question a little bit, Andy, because I don't think you exactly touched on it. In talking with the investors and users and their 3-to-1 desire to have the full lifetime losses accounted for, could you get a sense, or did they say specifically, whether they believe that the day one loss treatment through the P&L is appropriate, which would be in direct contrast with what Stephen mentioned the preparers were saying, or would you say that they simply accept the day one loss treatment through the P&L as a consequence of getting what they really want, which is the full lifetime losses as a reserve on the balance sheet?
Yeah, I would say the latter point that you made. And, you know, I think if you look at who we are talking to, it makes sense that the credit analysts and, to some extent, the ratings agencies analysts and some of those folks, you know, they really focused on, at least what they're telling us, the balance sheet, and they were willing to accept, you know, what's happening in the P&L. And, you know, as I was mentioning before, the reserve is, you know, very clearly labeled, and so therefore they can add it, adjust it, take it out, whatever they want to on the P&L. In fact, that's what a lot of folks already do. So it was really this emphasis on the balance sheet, you know, certainly by credit analysts and by ratings agencies analysts, and then also as well equities analysts. I don't know if Hal or Steve or Stephen, you have something to add there.
Cindy,
I was going to give the floor to Stephen.
Oh, me. Well, I was on a similar thing, really, and sort of the conceptual aspects of this again. So the preparers or the comment letters as a whole emphasize some of the conceptual problems, so the day one losses, the double counting, etc. And the users don't seem to my mind, have recognized the same thing, and I don't really understand why. Now, maybe they just have a different conceptual way of thinking, or maybe they just want the allowance but do recognize the conceptual problems of day one losses, so it wasn't really quite clear. But what really confused me was paragraph 8A, it says, this is the top page 5, most of the investors said they view the allowance as representing capital set aside to absorb future expected losses. Now, to get capital set aside to absorb future expected losses, you have to have a day one loss. Because if you don't have the day one loss, you haven't got the change in capital. So I'm confused as to what conceptual, why they're thinking they like the full lifetime loss, and is it the capital side of it, or is it faithfully reflecting the economics? I'm not really quite sure.
I mean, my personal view, and I think it's consistent with what I heard, at least from many of the investors, is that the simple act of underwriting to sending that dollar of loan out the door is taking on that additional risk. And because
so they do want a day one loss.
And they do want the day one loss.
So they don't see a conceptual problem with that, whereas the majority of the comment letters do see a conceptual problem.
I think you emphasized the words future loss, and they don't see it as a future loss. It will become evident or discovered in the future as to which specific loan. But the act of sending out 100 loans on a given day, you know, because of your underwriting standards and how you choose to run your own business, that losses were incurred, mistakes were made at that point in time. It's just a question of how will those mistakes be discovered?
Is it when there's mistakes? Because the CECL model isn't predicated on mistakes being made. It is the full lifetime loss content. Mm-hmm. So what about situations where presumably not all banks make mistakes? What about some of the banks that actually do have decent underwriting standards and appropriately priced for risk? Would the analysts want to see the lifetime losses recognized for all banks?
Mistakes are made in terms of assessment because you're trying to push volume out the door. You can do too many loans and too few loans. You're trying to find that balance between the two. And when I say mistakes, they're just judgment errors. You don't know which ones, but you know that you're not going to be perfect. If you're perfect, you're not going to push out enough loans out. And if you're too sloppy, you're going to push out too many loans.
Why would the analyst want to recognize all of the future losses on day one and none of the future revenue?
You use the word future, and I think the analysts, at least the ones I'm familiar with and the ones I heard from in this context, they're looking at the simple underwriting process as where the mistakes are occurring. Or the losses are being incurred.
We argue about economics and concepts. And I just think we talk past each other, and there are different concepts in economics that we can capture in the approaches that we've explored. You start with a model that says carry the value of the asset at fair value. That's a concept. That's one form of economics. Someone else could say that under an amortized cost model, where the business model is to cash collect out the instrument, what you want as your carrying value is what you expect to cash collect out. The contractual cash flows minus the impairment. That's a conceptual argument. They are at odds with each other, but I don't think that either one of those, and we can't achieve both very easily.
I know you can throw that.
I know, Steve. I've read the alternative view. Without creating an extra debit that is a little hard to explain. I know you weren't going to say that. But, we sort of talked cross purposes with each other. What is the purpose of the measurement? If it's fair value, that's one thing. If it's cash flows, it's another thing. And I think we can have different arguments about both. I don't think any one is more conceptually better than the other. It's what you're trying to achieve. I don't believe there's a matching argument here to be had at all. When I was taught matching, and when I erroneously taught matching early in my academic career, costs drive benefits. Expenses create revenue. I've never heard of a loss creating revenue. There's not a link between the incurrence or using up that and getting revenue. That's not a matching. It's not matching. But we could very well agree economically that if you do not recognize any impaired losses in a period, you would over-recognize the net return that you might be expecting on that particular asset for a period of time by having the cash flows and the interest precede the losses that appear later on.
But before we talked about that this isn't an occurred model. It's all about expectations. And the difference in our argument is what was the event or information or condition that caused an expectation. I believe the investors that Shandy have been describing say, if I issue a loan with certain underwriting standards, there has been an event that creates an expectation with that underwriting standard that there will be a loss. And we have to decide what events or conditions or information cause us to recognize an expectation of a loss before it's incurred.
And they're not just future losses, you're saying?
They're not future losses. They're created by the issuance of the asset with expected credit risk.
But didn't the creation of that loan also create expectations about future revenue? So
not the bad loan. That's the problem. The bad loan, you don't get any revenue for. The good loan, you do.
But the good loan you recover over time. The bad loan is created with the underwriting.
Well, isn't that conservatism? I mean, if you're saying that the event that created the loss is the underwriting activity, the event that created the income is the underwriting activity as well.
Cost subsidies.
And I don't understand this difference between the fair value and the future cash flows, because obviously they at inception of the loan they are the same.
It's what it comes down to is
it's your average expectation of your future cash flows, including average losses made on this kind of loan.
What it comes down to is a difference in discount rate. Because if you were to say the cash flows, you could discount it at the risk-free rate because the impairment picks up the unexpected cash flows and you'd be back at fair value. But if what we really do, and the investors have told us strongly, I think all of us, that they want the interest income at the effective interest rate and they want the credit separate. And the only way to do that is to discount the cash flows at an effective interest rate that's not the risk-free rate in terms of presentation.
Tom, follow what you just said. The event to create loans is the event to create the loss. You just say, how about PPE, inventory, and equity investment?
There's not a loss in there unless you sell it below value. But the PPE, inventory, and equity stuff, the equity investments, you're talking about actually incurring costs to generate revenue. Depreciation expense uses up for benefit to create revenue. Losses don't create revenue. Expenses create revenue.
No. You just said, I create a loan. That loan have possibilities to have credit loss. And based on what you just said, you should recognize that loss day one.
I'm going to suggest that we go back to the feedback. What we actually heard and not what we think about what we heard and or what other people might think. PK.
I just wanted to ask FASB, particularly the staff. I've been on the board for more than 4.5 years and I've never seen, and this is not a comment in a negative way, but I've never seen where the users and preparers to be diverged this widely. In any other projects, I mean, the revenue leases and things like that. The two occasions we have done this is when the preparers and users had different view. It was in disclosures areas, but in revenue and leases, we brought them together, at least a subset of people, to talk it out. Because if the same economics, two different people are viewing it differently, and one user group and one preparer group, any thought to bring them together to see if anything can come out, one can convince the other? Because I'm a little puzzled with this kind of thing. How would you go forward? I know you will say that these financial statements are for the user and all that good stuff, but preparers are a very important part of it, and they are saying that they cannot tell their story about their performance if they have a day one loss. And users are saying, no, we want the day one loss to understand the performance. So it's completely interesting to see how we can bring them together.
Yeah, please.
I think we first need to bring the users together. we have The FAA did a substantial amount of outreach with the ISB. The ISB did a substantial amount of outreach with the FSB. And CFA did a survey. And all of it is aligned. But the users have a different view between whether or not you are using US GAAP versus you're using IFRS today. And I don't think that's ever substantially happened. I think we need to ask ourselves, why is it that the customer of the information, one takes an income statement approach and one takes a balance sheet approach? Why is it that other constituent groups seem to be aligned, some to the FASB approach and some to the ISB approach, and everyone's aligned that we should do convergence, but no one's telling us how to do it? It seems to me we ought to think about how can we bridge the gap between what some people view as extremely important, which is a balance sheet approach, and others view, which is extremely important, as an income statement approach. And that's how we ought to work through to figure out a way to do convergence. But I think your point about is before we bring users and preparers, we've got to figure out why it is that the users are giving us diverse information by in essence, the historical information they've used.
That's fine. Either users first, then the users and preparers are within the U.S. get some kind of a thing, because I think I'm here picking and choosing what I like here, because there's so much message here. I can take anything I want and find a supporter here.
Mary?
A bit afraid that I'm going to bring us to a low note here. Just a question. I'm not sure if it's for Steve or John, but we were just talking before about B9 and the Pat Finnegan's explanation of the forecast for the lifetime expected loss. Is that consistent with, or how does our ISB view of lifetime expected loss of bucket, stage two, stage three, align with or differ from the clarification that's in B9?
It's the same.
It's same.
Our understanding's the same. I think that when we spoke to our preparers, I think they were less confused of what we meant in the same place, but that description's the same as how I would describe what we meant.
Okay.
So I think at least at the moment our lifetime stage two, stage three would be the same as the FASB's measurement.
Okay, I think we have...
Just one?
Yes,
just a technical one. How many years do you hear the reasonable and supportable forecast from the investors and preparers?
I mean, we
generally roughly.
Sure. I mean, we heard ranges all the way from 1 year up to 2-3 years, maybe even more than that, depending on the level of sophistication of that entity. So it really just was getting down to what did we mean by forecasting, and then once we talked through that, it just really depended on who you were talking to in terms of how far out.
So is there a general tendency between the so-called good books and bad books? If stage one or stage two in our terms of IFRS? No. But is there some kind of comparability among these feedbacks about this forecast period?
I don't know.
I can tell you that rating agencies, two large rating agencies, use the term outlook. And in their definitions of that, they mean 12 to 18 months.
I think that's consistent with what we've seen in the field work, so that you obviously forecast for the near future, and then you revert to, yeah.
So in that case, you are suggesting a good lesson to preparers, because they have some misunderstanding of the FASB model. So based on your evaluation, you provide extra maybe education service to preparers. So in our FASB model, you don't have to forecast beyond reasonable the supportable forecast period. It depends on them maybe 1 year or 2 years, 3 years. So if they can have some kind of practical experience. So after that lesson, they said, yes, in this case, we have no big problem in implementing FASB model. But if you see from that feedback, there are some problems. One problem is maybe that you, the UK entry model looks like similar to the 12-month period model of the ISP. Another thing is because we said, we just let the preparers choose supportable, reasonable forecast period, there is a kind of flexibility among choosing that forecasting period. After that, they can use some historical average to calculate the expected credit losses. But it seems to me, if we lose comparability of the using this full lifetime expected loss model, and in practice, they are using some kind of a short period of a forecast period. So basically, the final outcome might be quite similar to their maybe 12-month period. How about
Well, no, because you're still trying to measure the lifetime loss content. It's just how you get there. So it's not truncated at 12 months. It's just the adjustments you make to the information. And I have to say that even though we had that clarification with people we spoke to, I don't think they got the same level of comfort that preparers seem to have got on the FASB side, because the feedback we got was that the adjustments were, first of all, building historical lifetime information was very difficult, but also it was the adjustments even in the near term to that historical information to take account of the effect of the forecast information that was the most challenging. So it wasn't the tail where they were having the trouble. It was in the near term where we expected them to do the more granular assessment.
And then we have to stop.
Can I think for a question?
Yes.
No. In many cases, we've often heard, different users, particularly equity and debt users, will have different views on balance sheet-based or income sheet-based. On this one, is there any difference from FSB survey? Or they hold exactly the same view? Shandy.
Oh, sure. Well, as I was saying before, I feel like the credit analysts, there was very little diversity in view. They were very supportive of a lifetime expected credit loss approach, recognition approach. I think it was more mixed in equity analysts, and it comes back to the extent to which, they're relying on the income statement and the understanding of the spread and the pre and post provision, and whether or not they think that, it's onerous to take those credit losses up front without the commensurate, interest income recognition. So you saw a little bit more of a mix in the equity analyst, but still, the majority favoring the recognition of lifetime expected credit losses.
Okay. That brings us to the end of the public meeting for today. We're going to continue with some small group meetings. Thank you very much. We continue tomorrow.